Wafting across the pastoral vistas of the new basement studios by the lake, this is the Atlantic Voice Podcast, 3,000 miles of opinion.
This is Atlantic Voice Podcast. I'm Zeph.
And I'm Eric.
Down in New Basement Studios by the lake, we have a packed show today.
Right.
We have plenty of topics to get through.
Oh, none of which we will have in great depth, right?
No, and I will. I do have a quick thing to say about topics, and I will circle back to it as we go through the news. I have a quick aside about the topics that we choose to talk about.
Okay.
Some listener interaction.
Sure.
Yeah. Oh, do you want me to start with that?
Oh, yeah, I think
so.
Well, so
I'm talking to a 12-year-old. And she says to me, "You guys are quite funny, but you talk about some strange topics." And I'm like, "What do you mean?" And the kid goes, "He did a whole show on coffee and chocolate." And she's sort of turning her nose up at these topics.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, "Yeah, okay." And I just ignored her. She's 12.
She didn't have any suggestions for topics we should cover?
No, she didn't, other than you should get different topics. Oh. But she did concede she thought you were quite amusing.
Oh.
So it was like a two-sided, it was both compliment and insult. And as it was from a 12-year-old, I just nodded. And then
are 12-year-olds supposed to be listening to our coffee episode?
I don't know.
I could understand that they would be pretty bored by that unless they're prematurely drinking coffee.
Yes, so, yeah.
But chocolate, I mean, that would sell.
I would have thought so, especially if you were 12. I couldn't have thought, but maybe she hadn't agreed with our many opinions about chocolate.
Right.
So anyway, that was just some topic.
Uh-huh.
So let's get started with the news. We have some listener, not listener feedback, but a listener question.
Yeah, an inquiry.
Our good friend Christian emailed us and wanted to know why the song Swing Low, Sweet Chariot was sung by rugby fans. Because obviously the Rugby World Cup is reaching its climax. This weekend is the semifinals.
Mm-hmm.
And I found it interesting to see that it was actually on over-the-air broadcast American television.
Yeah, what is it on?
NBC.
It's on NBC Sports Network. Yeah, I guess they figure it out.
No, they actually played it on. I think they played it on the network yesterday,
right?
Because they had the Premier League game. They had the 5:30 back in England, 12:30 here in America. They played that game in the free over-the-air network.
Right.
And then after that, I think because they have a strange old fall sports package, they then had the New Zealand South Africa World Cup semi-final, which was very interesting.
Where's it being held, do you know?
Being held in England.
Oh, okay. It's just, so much the better. Maybe that's why they can just use the same, like, crews, basically. Not that, obviously, in the Premier League, they all have one video feed, but they have people working there, so maybe they could have people work on the World Cup.
Yeah, so, I think they took the world feed. But anyway, Christian asked about the song Swing Low, Sweet Chariot, and about why it's been co-opted by the English rugby team.
Is it just English? I can't remember.
Well, that was his question. Why is it sung by the England rugby team? So,
the team doesn't sing it before the game, do they?
Well, they might do. I was a rugby player in my youth.
Oh, yeah?
I played rugby in school.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I came to America, I played for the local rugby club because it was an interesting way to try and meet people.
Sure. Were you one of the fast types or the ones who smashing your heads against each other?
I was one of the ones smashing their heads against each other because, I only have speed of thought rather than speed of leg.
Well, let's not overestimate that.
And so rugby traditionally, when you played it, you just played it at an amateur level.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was the same it's the same all the way through every step of rugby, is that rugby is a very hospitable game in that you have people running and people smashing their heads against each other.
People drinking beer.
And then people drinking beer after.
Right.
And you'd all go to the local pub or whatever clubhouse or whatever watering hole it was, and people would drink and sing songs. And I remember that was the first time that I'd swung Swing Low, Sweet Chariot. I'd sung it, yes, and then I swung it later after many beers. This was before it had been co-opted as the English sort of...
You were singing it as a part of the pub songs, but it wasn't permeated to the fan base and like something that during the game.
No, but what I'm seeing is, Christian's specific question was, why was this England song?
Yep.
And the point I'm making is, it's a rugby song, which ultimately has been very much co-opted by England in terms of they record it as an anthem, the team will record it, or they'll get special, singers to record special versions before the World Cups. If anyone remembers, we did, our whole Soccer World Cup preview last year was about the songs that the different nations do. And this also happens in the Rugby World Cup. So my point to Christian was, well, it's really a rugby song rather than an English rugby song.
Okay. You're gonna answer the secondary question, right?
What's the secondary question?
Well, why is it a rugby song?
I don't know why it's a... Well...
It was not a very good answer to basically say, well, you know, it's not really an England song, it's a rugby song, because then people are still just going to ask, why is it a rugby song, given the fact that it's an American spiritual, African-American spiritual, right?
So this is my point here, is that I went and researched this, and I typed into the internet, why do rugby fans sing Sweet Low, Sweet Chariot? And according to a story from bbc.co.uk, England supporters were rumoured to have adopted the song when a group of schoolboys began singing it at Twickenham, which is England's national rugby stadium, in 1988. Now, when that story came out, other rugby club members or rugby players claimed that they had started the trend even before that. I am to show here that...
You're ruffling papers to show.
I've done some research. So what I'm saying is, England rugby fans claim that they adopted it, and no one knows exactly why this song was adopted. I couldn't find that other than who started to sing it back in the late 80s. But the point I'm making to you is, even before that, I personally was in a rugby playing environment where this was one of those songs that you sang later when you'd had a few beers to drink. Mm-hmm. That's my point, is that we're sort of running double questions here in terms of why it's been adopted by rugby. That I did not know. Why it was adopted by the English rugby team, hopefully I've just answered Christian, that a group of schoolboys at a game, at a national game, claimed to have started getting their whole section singing it back in the late 80s.
Yeah, we're not answering the now, question. I'm trying to research as we go here, but...
Well, no, I'm looking at another quote here from this same bbc.co.uk article. I do. It says here, some rugby fans claim to have sung it as early as the 1960s, but this was as part of a drinking game accompanied with an elaborate series of sexual hand gestures. So I think my point is, Swing Low, Swing Chariot has always been a drinking song.
Well, no. It was originally a...
No, okay.
Right.
Yes. No, I mean...
That's the real question, is how did it make a leap from being this African-American spiritual, you know, having to do with slavery and related to...
Well, let me tell you about that song. The song is thought to have been composed by a slave called Wallace. That's actually his name, Wallace. His first name spelled A-C-E at the end. His last name, Wallace, L-L-I-S. Who, together with his wife Minerva Wallace, in the mid-1800s, put together this old spiritual song, and apparently it conveyed a coded message to slaves instructing them to escape. Okay. That's the actual history of the song from 200 years ago. Professor Boyer, a professor from, I think, Cambridge University, told the BBC back at the turn of this millennium that theory fitted into the notion that a group of spirituals would rather die than be here. Just, you know, it's all about escape, and either spiritual escape or physical escape. It is a sad song, according to this academic. It is almost a language of double entendres. It has one meaning for you and another meaning for somebody else, which therefore, and I say this now about a lot of sort of chants and songs, another group take it entirely. They like the way it sounds, the way it can be sung, and they have absolutely no idea the history of the song. So what I'm saying is, when rugby fans or English rugby fans or any set of rugby fans are singing Swing Low, Swing Chariot, it's not because they are tying its original meaning to their game. It just happens to be a song that they sing.
I see one of the things says that it was suggested that it was in response to the Nigerian-born player on the English team. So it had some racial connotations. In any event, the Independent...
I did not see that. Well, there you go.
The Independent UK says, is basically, this is part of an article saying, you should all stop singing this. You know, like grabbing something that has that kind of history and tie-in and using it as a song to sing about the sports team is not appropriate cultural appropriation. So like appropriation.
Yeah, so like I say, clearly its relationship with the English national team or being an English supporter, that does seem to have a history here. I've also looked through my research, and yes, these kids who are alleged to have begun singing at a rugby match were serenading a black player, Chris Oatey.
Yeah, that's what I was just
saying. Yes,
about.
And but what I'm saying is my own personal experience is it's been a drinking / rugby song prior to the late 80s. And again, so there you go. We probably haven't answered Christian's question, but at the end of the day, we've done plenty of research and thrown in some facts to keep him busy.
Yeah, we burned quite a few minutes on
that. Yeah, so there you go. So that's news. That was we also have some asteroid news.
Right. You know,
not even a segue there. We just plowed straight into.
People know we're in charge of keeping everybody posted on the situation with asteroids attacking the Earth and meteors attacking the Earth. Turns out, like in very recent notice, oh look, we just noticed it. A 1300 foot, so we're looking at
yes, and before you move on, I guess the NASA's Center for Near Earth Object Studies, this is 1300 feet wide, 400 meters, and even though they've just discovered it,
so that's almost a mile. That's pretty big.
No, 400 meters. It's 1300 feet, not 1300.
Oh, not 1300
feet. 1300 feet, 400 meters.
A third of a mile.
They've only just discovered it. Right? That's what all these articles say. Yet, the NASA's Center for Near Earth Object Studies, while it has been assigned a number, because they give all these objects flying around.
TB-145.
Well, according to this article, it's already been nicknamed the Great Pumpkin and Spooky.
Right.
So while they've only just discovered it, they definitely seem to think that one of the most important things was to give it a name.
Well, because it's Halloween time, you know. So 20 times bigger than the one that came down in Russia. You know, it's the kind of thing, if it hit us, real material environmental issues potentially could ensue. Supposedly coming in, it's not as close as the moon, but it's not too much further.
It's just on the other side. And again, this is where I was very concerned when I read about this. Although TB-15 will hurtle by, quote, relatively close by celestial standards, that is the quote from the NASA spokesman, basically we're not in any danger. As far as I'm concerned, if this thing is massive and it's just the other side of the moon, by any standards, that's too close.
Well, it's like if somebody's shooting bullets at you and they miss you, you weren't in any danger, right? I mean, I think you were in danger.
Yeah, that's
what happens in
danger. I don't know. I just feel like when I read this article about this, I was a bit thrown off by NASA's just general attitude that, yeah, you know.
Awfully
just,
blasé.
Oh, and we've even given it a nickname. Yeah. Well, it's
that's
not blasé
they just
to
noticed,
me.
They noticed that at the last minute, the last thing they want to do is be alarmist, to be like, oh, yeah, sure, we just noticed at the last minute, but this one's nothing to worry about. I mean, it's just a bullet whizzing by your ear.
So the spokesman also went on to assure the public that the skies are clear of danger and there are no credible impact threats to date.
Okay.
These are the same people who only just noticed a couple of weeks ago that this thing was actually somewhere near Earth. So at the end of the day, if you're worried about asteroids, we're the people you should listen to, not NASA.
Not NASA, that's
NASA's
right.
Very blasé attitude towards the whole thing. And at some moment in time, we're going to get them.
Yep.
Somebody.
Yep.
So that's your latest asteroid news. And again, I think it's coming. I'm trying to think. It's actually going to be closest to Earth on Halloween.
Yeah. I think that's why they named it the Great Pumpkin.
Well, I understand that. But still, this whole notion of, let's give it a stupid name. Well, it's not stupid to me. No one's laughing in that Bruce Willis movie. Armageddon.
Yeah, yeah.
People laugh. This is hilarious.
Buscemi made a lot of jokes.
At the predicament.
Oh, no, right. Yeah, no, that was serious.
So, anyway, there's asteroids.
Okay. We had a little bit about, which unfortunately I don't have the article pulled up anymore, but the somebody stole the Google.com domain briefly.
Yeah, we ran across. This was quite interesting. An unassuming fanboy bought and briefly owned Google.com.
Yeah, I think he was just doing a bit where, you know, you go check online, you can see what domains are available.
Yeah.
And so he was playing around with variations on Google, and he said, what the heck, I'll try Google.com, and he was actually able to register it.
And for those of you that don't know, if you live online and you have a website, you first have to you rent the space from a provider, but you actually physically own the name.
Yeah, I mean, it's like a whole system who minister. Like, you don't own it in a sense of permanence because you have to pay every month. Not every month. Over a period of time, you pay. Like, yeah. You have a registration with, I forget the name of the organization that keeps track of all the domain names. And in fact, I think it's different organizations now for different sets.
Can I circle back to my 12-year-old buddy who goes, yep. What's your website again? AtlanticVoice.com. And I had to go, it's AtlanticVoice.net.
Yeah.
Because .com was already taken.
Yeah, we should and check, of course, occasionally because maybe they let it lapse and we could grab the .com
domain. And what, and buy both?
Yeah, I mean, then you just route them both to the same place.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, you don't have to have two websites or anything like
that. So anyway, he was surfing around and he saw that Google.com was available.
Yep.
So he paid us $20 and...
Like, apparently the way it works is it basically says you don't have anything until we charge your card. If we charge your card, you have it. And they charged his card and then they came back and they said, oh, no, you don't have that. Because obviously somebody somewhere... Because I think even the company that runs this domain thing is a Google affiliated company.
Yeah.
And they were like... Oh, no, we didn't mean that. You don't have that thing. And I think it said Google paid him some amount of money. I think right out of the gate, they were like, somebody messed up here. And last thing we need is this guy claiming he actually owns the Google.com domain name.
Well, he was also refunded his $12.
Yeah.
It's actually less than $20. And apparently you're correct. Google paid him off. And he then said he was going to donate the money to an educational program back in India.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I'm assuming he was originally from India. I guess his last name...
Somebody couldn't be altruistic towards Indian schools?
Well, no, because his last name is Ved, V-E-D. So I'm assuming that his name is San May Ved.
Oh,
so I'm now stereotyping and guessing that he's probably of Indian descent, which was why he wanted to support... a needy cause back in India. And then at that moment, what I'm
you
saying
should, you should
Google
have
threw in more money.
You should change your last name to that. You'd be Zef Zed.
Yeah, Zef Ved or Ved Zef.
Oh, Zef Ved.
But then Google, when he made a pronouncement that he was going to donate what Google gave him, they went and gave him more money.
Yeah.
I have a funny feeling I know what happened. Some guy down at Google, some mid-level guy, he works for Google. And his job is to ensure that no one is infringing upon Google's property. So he's gone to the domains, and he's responsible looking for anyone else who's got anything Google-like. So google.co.uk, Googlelist, or whatever it may be. And, of course, this massive corporation had forgotten to realize that you also have to own your own name before making sure you've got control of anything else that's similar to yours. And I'm guessing that's what happened. Someone somewhere hadn't paid the $12.
Yeah, that just made
me. So next time you're upset that your internet has crashed, well, this is the operation that you're dealing with.
What I wonder, because Google's like transitioning to a new name. Like, they have this overall company name, Alphabet, or maybe, I can't remember which way they're going.
Yes.
They got this new, maybe in the course of setting that up, they kind of left Google.com away for a second.
But I give Google their due within... What is it? I need to look back over the article.
It's very quick. I mean, it's
about a minute.
Yeah.
But I'm telling you, if I was San May Ved, I'd really be taking Google to the sword.
Yeah, but see, it starts by saying he's a big fan of Google, and so...
No, good for him, but I'd still try and jam him up.
Yeah.
Because,
I'm sure you would.
Yes. So there's Google. You have some computer news.
Yeah, that I bought a new computer recently, and it has Windows 10 on it. Right, so now I never did the Windows 8 with the blocks and stuff like that. So now Windows 10 is sort of in between, like the Windows you're accustomed to, with a little start menu and the stuff that's almost like tablet based. In fact, this computer is one of those ones that's convertible. It folds all the way back, and it's a Lenovo Yoga Pro 3. I'm pretty pleased with it so far. But it really tells you how much tablets and iPads have taken over, because like programs are now like called apps, and like you can go to a store, like it's very similar to a tablet in function, but at the end of the day you're getting a full tablet in terms of style, a lot of big blocks, things you can touch with your hand, you can do all that sort of stuff, but it's full-blown computer underneath it. So like we got it, you could have gotten another tablet. I think Microsoft is the Surface tablet.
That's right.
We wanted to have something with full-blown Word on it, because all the members of the Atlantic Voice household do a lot of work with documents, and we need to have a complete word processing software and email. Like email is interesting, right? Like, so nowadays we use a Yahoo email address or something like that. On your computer, normally you just go to the website. on like iPads and tablets and phones, you have like an app that accesses your email. Well, now this has an app, right? So you could go to the website and get your email, but you can also put your information in and you just press an email square on the screen and it now takes you to something very much like you would use on a phone or a tablet.
Can I ask you a question? When you were out buying this, were you out looking for a new laptop? Mm-hmm. Or were you looking for a tablet? Or I've heard about the ones that are both. I want both. I'm asking about where you were as a shopper before you bought this.
No, well, we need a new laptop. The laptop we've got is pretty old and starting to fall apart, and it's really heavy and clunky. And so I went looking around for new laptops. And when I say looking around, this was all on the internet. I mean, it was another one I figured everything out, and then I found out what it was, and I went and got it. But the fact that it's a really super skinny and, you know, one of these long battery life type things, and it had the folding back, it was an attractive option because it
did. So that's what I'm saying. You weren't specifically looking for a laptop that had this laptop/tablet function, or tab-top, actually, as I'm now going to refer to it. And I'm now
make that,
or a laplet.
I think they're called convertibles or something.
Now forget
like that.
I've just done what Google have done. Yeah. We now own laplet and tab top. So if I see that anywhere else, it's now copyright Atlantic Voice. I'm trademarking it right now. It's our intellectual property.
Yeah,
if
really
I see it anywhere
way,
else, we're going to sue.
Good effort.
No, but that's why I find it interesting that you weren't specifically looking for this sort of two-in-one thing, but you found it and you thought, that swings.
Well, I was looking for a laptop, and when I found one that had this, I was like, well, that's pretty good.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
Like, you can set it up so it's like sort of...
Did you get a sense that this was the way it's going?
I would think so. I mean, no. Here's the thing. So it's Windows 10.
Was it one more attempt by Microsoft?
So this is new Windows. Well, I mean, they're going to succeed because everybody uses it for business purposes. But it's... It is, they are doing the most to converge the systems. So now this thing is between the two. And so if you did get a Microsoft phone or a tablet, it's not going to be all that different in the way it appears and behaves. So they're pulling it all together. And I think it's probably tells you, like, the next computer you're going to get at your office, everybody, all the offices and businesses skipped Windows 8 or whatever it was because it was so touch heavy. Well, now this is like it can do both, and so it's gonna, I think this will be the next wave of when everybody gets their upgrades in their offices will be Windows 10.
Do you want to talk about Back to the Future at this moment?
Yeah, we can talk about that, and we'll come back to something related to the laptop there in a second. So the one of the things in the news, since it's
this
news,
past week,
right, was that October, was it the
21st of October?
October 21st
was the day in. Is it Back to the Future 2?
Yeah, October 21st, 2015, and Back to the Future 2, where he goes forward.
Which I've not seen.
Not seen.
I saw Back to the Future,
useful.
The first one, where he goes to the late 50s, early 60s. And I saw Back to the Future 3, where it's a Western.
Yeah.
Back to the Future 2, I never saw.
Yeah, 2 was... I think 2, he actually goes to... He goes
Back
forward.
Back to the Future 3 should be just back to the back.
Anyway, so that's the date he goes forward to. There's also, like, they also go back. It's kind of a weird thing, which we'll talk about in a second, that there was an article in the Washington Post talking about how the problem with the Back to the Future franchise in retrospect. But... that's the date in the future, and so a bunch of people are doing articles about things that have happened and things that haven't happened, right? Like, so they had the hoverboards and flying cars, and we don't have flying cars.
You know,
some amateur versions of hoverboards, but like a lot of stuff about video conferencing, like Skype and stuff, that stuff has come true.
Obviously, you know, when stuff like this happens, all kinds of journalists get assigned to immediately write articles that are somehow relevant. The Guardian, which we always support, it's one of the places we support. I read an article that had the most stupid headline ever, and it was an article tied into this whole Back to the Future 21st of October thing. The headline was, "Why don't we have flying cars?" And I started to read it, and then I'm like, actually, we do have flying cars. They're called planes and helicopters.
Well, no.
There's dumb journalism. I was very angry. And my point is this, and I'm not just piling on, and let me name them in case they want to retweet us. John Preston and Ben Waterson, I'm not just piling on them.
Yeah, they're definitely going to want to retweet us after you pile on.
Because, again, it's a dumb headline. And it's a dumb thrust.
Well, remember, writers don't write their headlines.
Okay, well, they can use that excuse. So, but my point is, the whole notion... Like, there was I understand it's just modern life and modern media, but the notion on Wednesday that every other minute seemed to be a Back to the Future article, I'm like, it's a film.
Yeah.
It's just a film.
And we do, what do you mean?
Well, what I'm saying is people have suddenly, people have sort of reverse engineered Back to the Future I understand at a certain moment, it's a cute thing to say, this popular film, how accurate was it?
Right.
That's fine. But then I saw a whole load of articles now getting into transportation and all sort of thing.
But I mean, I thought what you...
Because
I thought
now you're applying seriousness to the notion that some great scientific thinker predicted that in 25 years... No, a bunch of movie guys did some stuff. So what I'm saying, it's a cute story that seemed to suddenly, to me, get a lot more traction than it should.
Well, so they... I thought where you were going to go with that is the fact that everybody gets assigned these articles, yeah, and they have to be like, well, I can't just do the same thing everybody else does. So flying cars is pretty close to what everybody else does, predictions with what everybody else does. Washington Post had an article talking about how they also coordinated a re-release or a release of a DVD set of the three movies.
Okay, fair enough.
And they were talking about the fact that the back to the, like, they're fashioning it as a trilogy. You know, like, we now have, like, Lord of the Rings trilogies, Star Wars trilogies.
Well, it is a trilogy.
But not really. It was, like, the first movie was just the movie. The others are sequels. It's much more of, like, Jaws 2, Jaws 3. It's not, like, a preconceived arc of different plots. It's, they did the first one. It made a ton of money. And somebody said, we really need you to make a second one.
It's the same as Lethal Weapon. When they made the first Lethal Weapon, they were not thinking in Lethal Weapon 4,
right,
he can have a family.
Right.
Which is what he has in
Lethal
Weapon.
So the Post article, which I don't have up, so I can't credit whoever the author was, but the first one was a really interesting, you know, somebody came up with a new idea. It was, what, 1985? So it's the beginning. It's that Michael J. Fox.
It's certainly
it's
a great film.
Powers. Yeah, and, you know, it's witty and unusual and sort of a new idea. The second one, it's like, yeah, kind of done that. And so we flash forward, and I don't know if you remember, well, because you didn't see the second one. So in the second one, in addition to flashing forward, they actually flash back to the 1955 period also.
Okay.
And they basically overlay another plot. So like in the first one, he's back there visiting with his parents and stuff
to make
like
sure
that
they meet.
Right.
And then his mom hits on him.
In the second one, there's another version of him back there. So it's literally like reshot versions of the first movie where, like, so there's this whole scene at the prom, his parents' prom.
So it's a reboot.
Right. Scene at the parents' prom where Michael J. Fox is there in the first one.
Like,
he plays, yeah, he plays, yeah, the guitar to get them all back together. Well, in the second one, he's also there up in the rafters because the other version of him from the next movie is back. And so they're now overlaying the movie on top of its own self.
So he can see himself.
Exactly.
Who has already traveled back in
exactly
time. Being already he's supposed to be. I'm getting confused.
Right. So they overlay.
Oh, that's clever.
Well, what the guy was saying is in the article was like, they've watered down the original movie by putting sequels that, like, it's not the worst sequel in the world, but they were definitely watered down. And the Western one where it goes out, you know, that just had nothing
to do with
it.
Yeah, I had no idea what that was about. I only went because I really
so now
wanted,
when they,
really
when
the
they, when they build this as a trilogy, it's really, like, detracting from the significance of the first movie, right? So the fact that even this whole thing about the flash forward, that's only from two. That's not from the first movie, the movie that we all think of as Back to the Future. This whole flashing forward thing is from the second movie, which is just sort of like a bit more of a throwaway.
I do want to say one thing. One of the predictions that it made that it also, I think the more serious prediction that it completely failed on, is the fact that everyone who was in Back to the Future, with the exception of Michael J. Fox, I don't know the rest of them.
They didn't accurately predict
that their careers would go in the toilet.
You know, they changed up characters, right? Like so Crispin Glover was his father in the first one, but not in the second and the third one. Like so,
yeah. What's Crispin Glover doing now? That's my point. Michael J. Fox has got an excuse because he's got Parkinson's. Yeah, his career is still greater than
all
these other
dudes.
Well, no, because I don't want to be doing. I've always a big Michael J. Fox fan, and I'm not trying to be throwaway about his condition.
He's doing all right,
but where's everyone else?
I don't know. I mean, what happened
to Biff?
Elizabeth Shue. She's doing all right.
Well, she wasn't on the CSI finale.
Okay. Well, she's supposed to be.
There you go. Oh. Well, she was on that show.
Oh, okay. Well, I don't know.
Who's Biff? What happened to him? Crispin Glover, where are you now?
Oh, Crispin Glover still does stuff.
Doc, where are you now? That's my point.
You know, he wanted to, because of course, you know, the other thing.
They should have gone to the future to rescue their own careers.
So the other interesting, in 2015, in the movie, the second one, it's all set, I think it's all set in Chicago, but the Cubs win the World Series.
Yes.
And so it was,
and they were
for a little while there, it looked like it was going to go, and apparently, what's the guy's name? Christopher Lloyd played Doc.
Yes.
He was getting all set. He wanted to throw the pitch out during the World Series as like Doc Brown, and if the Cubs went to the World Series. But
they lost in 5.
Not to pass, yeah.
Or 4. Swept. Thanks for coming.
Yeah.
You're going back to the past.
Yeah.
Chicago Cubs. I don't know if we have any fans in Chicago.
Oh, sure we do. Yeah. I was there recently. It was very nice.
Oh, good.
Yeah. Speaking of travel. Yeah,
so that was this week.
Yeah. So speaking of travel, and this is one of the reasons I was looking for a new computer, a smaller computer, is we're going away for a little while here for a vacation out of the continent. Nice long flight and all that. Wanted to have good gear available. But one of the interesting things was, so for these long flights, you know, the pricing between regular class and business class, or just two, the airplane's mostly two class now, although I guess some of the British ones have three classes.
But. Yeah. I mean, there's first class, which is all the way up there. It's basically like having your own private jet. I mean, first class is super expensive when you go anywhere.
Yeah.
But you're right.
It's like four or five times the price of like the regular. So we got a regular seat. And then just we're leaving in like a week, and we start getting these emails from the airline saying, hey, if you're interested in upgrading, come check this thing out. Now, I've gotten that before where somebody has said, hey, for $500 extra, we'll upgrade you.
It's like an eBay auction. It's
basically, they get to a certain point and they realize they haven't sold the first class tickets. They'd rather squeeze a couple of bucks.
So let's see what the market will pay. Yeah.
Well, this one, perfect market thing, they don't give you a price that you need to pay for the first class ticket or the business class ticket, whatever it is. They say, what will you offer us? And we'll let you know if we'll accept it. And so when you go to the website, there's like a little slider. It's kind of like if you've ever used StubHub where you can put a price and it says, here's what your odds are. And they're going to decide whether they do it. And so this will be interesting, you know, and the little slider's got a little highly likely, less likely kind of meter on the side when you slide between the two. Well, by rights, this number should start at 0, right? No, the lowest price you can pay is 150% of the price we paid for the ticket in the first place. So,
the ticket plus half of itself, or the ticket doubled plus half of itself?
It doubled plus half. Okay, right. So you got to pay for a whole other ticket and a half, basically, for that stuff. With that. And so you can't go any lower than, and even at that number, it's like, oh, your chances are very poor. And then the range is only about to 2.5, I think. So let's, like, for round numbers, tickets originally $1,000. For $1,500 extra, you can upgrade, and it says it's very poor chance. Like, if you bid that.
So
if you bid $2,500, it says the chance is great. And so you tell me there's this range in between these two numbers.
Yeah.
That this, and I don't, I, this is what made me not believe in them either at all.
Because it's a scam.
Yeah.
They're trying to fleece you.
Well, plus, yeah, so I'm not paying. I mean, if you told me I could offer you $300, $400, maybe I'd have a discussion about this to get a better seat, but I'm not doubling and a half the price of my ticket or so, just on the off chance I might get it. So we haven't bid on it.
No, I mean, and that does seem, I understand. I think the process is quite good. And we're not picking on any airline. We've not named them. The idea that, you know, here you go, you want an upgrade, let's interact.
Yeah.
I kind of like that. But you're right. The parameters for the interaction tell me what the price is and like it's a simple
yes. Yeah, let me offer you $300. You can decide whether you want to accept $300 for the extra.
Do you think
the numbers
changed at all as you get closer?
Yeah, I'm watching that this week.
Yeah.
But like if I go like two days from now, suddenly the bottom end of the range can be a lot lower because they're going to be like, nobody's bought at that price kind of thing. So I'll be watching that. Which brought to mind the fact we had an article, it's been a few weeks, but we had put aside the Washington Post ran an article, which I then got picked up when I went searching for it. It was like this stuff in Wired, this stuff in PC Magazine, but the article was by Andrea Peterson, October 7th, Why Airplane Makers Keep Trying to Patent Horrifying Seat Arrangements, and Airbus, I guess.
Airbus, yeah. Although Boeing have also, there's basically two people that build planes, Airbus and Boeing, and Airbus came in first and took all the heat, but Boeing have done the same thing.
So they're filing for patents on different seating arrangements.
Yes.
And the big thing on all these is racking people up. Like, instead of being like seats, next row of seats, there's like two tiers. Like, every other row is up higher.
Yes.
So basically you could sit on top of people.
Yeah.
You know, you could kind of picture how, like, if you make everybody into a little L shape, you can nest them.
Yeah.
And so, like, the feet of the people in the row ahead of you would be hanging in the faces of the people in the row behind. And they have a version where, like, the things would lay flat. So, like, one layer would lay flat underneath the other layer kind of thing. And everybody's looking at this going, oh, my God, is this what we're going to actually have to deal with planes in the future? Is, like, this sort of racking us up like sardines?
It's interesting that you say that, though. I actually think it's one of those things where... Just like the guy at Google.
Oh, yeah. No,
whose job is to buy up everything that's kind of similar. I do think they...
The point isn't that I believe that that's happening, but the fact that everybody's reaction was like, oh.
But someone's job is to patent all these different designs, because you never know. One day they might design something that's somewhat similar, and if they don't
own it... Oh, yeah. No, they want to grab it.
Well, because like I say, have you ever taken a sleeping car on a train...
I haven't, but I mean, I'm familiar
with them. Well, then there you have the pull-down beds that pop out of the water, and they are above each other, and all of a sudden you've stacked two people on, you know, I'm sure planes are thinking along. So what I'm saying is, as hideous and uncomfortable as some
maybe
of
they're
these
patenting it for
looks,
future space travel. I wonder if the patent covers space travel, just air travel. But I mean, like, listen, at the end of the day, it's particularly the lay flat version. I mean, that might be, like you said, on the train, that might actually be attractive in that regard.
I did see.
But the pictures, like, because you know when people file patents, they have these, like, sketches, you know, they're not photographs, and they're, like, really horrifying.
They all look like they're from Victorian times.
Yeah, they're really horrifying looking. Actually, those frightening ones, well, go ahead.
The one that looked like bicycle seats?
Yes, Like, so, like, one of them, it looks like a bad, like, amusement park ride. Like, it's not even a full seat, it's basically a bicycle seat that flips up. With two little braces for your arms.
Yes.
No backs or anything like that. And it's a way to potentially put everybody, like, super tight together.
It all looks like... when you see the pictures, they look like Terry Gilliam, Monty Python contraptions. Like, funny-looking bicycle things. But, yeah, apparently you would all sort of basically... Squat is the wrong word, but the first thing that came to mind when I saw these sort of row of bicycle seats was it similar to... You know, when you're standing in the pub and you're sort of squatting against a bar stool or something, it seemed more like that rather than a reclining seat. And I found it interesting that I couldn't quite figure out, funnily enough, with you looking for an upgrade, I wonder, would these things be cheaper or more expensive? Like, if you're willing to pay next to nothing, we'll put you in the bicycle seat row.
Yeah. Like, if you're willing to fly for 4 or 5 hours, like, maybe you just stand.
You just stand, yeah. Well, what will you get? What will you give us for standing? You know what I mean? So there you go. Are we ready to move on from airplanes? Because there is one thing I wanted to say about.
My handwriting for the one after this thing.
For your own benefit, because I know you're about to take a long trip. Mm-hmm. I saw an article this week that said that some airlines... We're actually getting rid of in-flight entertainment because their argument was people can just bring their own laptops or tablet devices to stream films and whatever. So why were they, you know, getting involved in the whole
Southwest
trying
and
to save some money with the whole back of the seat screen and all this type of thing? So I thought that was interesting.
That's true. Like, so most of those, they do that, but the streaming is... It's not like you just go on the internet and stream whatever you want to, which now I'm realizing this is what it's talking about. Streaming is my next item.
Can you stream on an airplane?
So a lot of them, they have free access to the stuff that they are offering. Like, in other words, they'll have a Wi-Fi signal in the plane, and they'll show you what they would have shown you on the seat backs. It's not, here's Wi-Fi access, and go to Netflix, go to Amazon, go to all that sort of stuff.
Basically, they don't want to spend the extra $60, £60 to build the seat with a screen in it. But that's the same.
They're
still going to provide you entertainment.
But they're providing you. I don't know.
You're going to bring your own screen.
Through internet or whatever it is. But they're getting a unified stream to the plane, or they have a recording on the plane instead of. It must be a stream because sometimes you get live stuff. But they don't want. Like, if basically you can get anything you want. I think the hundreds of people trying to pull in their own data from Netflix, from this, that, the other thing would be too much for a plane to handle, at least at this point. But you'd figure going forward when all that stuff
It's all cost cutting on that part, isn't it? I mean, if you're not serving people drinks, then you're saving money on the drinks, you're saving money on cups, you're saving money on napkins. It's no different now. Bring your, you know, in the same way that on a domestic flight, the chances are you've got to bring your own food and drink. If you're on a plane, you have to bring your own screen.
Yeah.
So there you go. That's news for the week.
Yeah. Although, I guess
the show 3/4 over.
Yeah. Well, I was going to say, speaking of Netflix, which I don't know if this qualifies as news or not.
No, but this was this was sort of the one major topic that we were considering. Right. At least I was.
Yeah. So Netflix just recently put out a movie. Like, the movie was released in theaters and Netflix at the same time.
So it's Beasts.
I don't think it's a Netflix promoted, because it was out in a bunch of festivals. No, had really good reviews, but they got the right somehow.
They got the right, but what I'm saying is it is
a Netflix original. Netflix first original movie.
I'm under the assumption let's tell people the movie. It stars Idris Elba. It's called Beast of No Nation.
It's about like child soldiers in Africa.
Directed by the guy who was one of the executive producers of a show that you like, True Detective. He was...
Yes, that's right. I forgot.
Fukushima something or other. Yes. But he was one of the executive producers of one of Eric's favorite shows, True Detective. Mm-hmm. I know for season one. I don't know if he was involved in season two.
No, he's actually listed as an executive producer, but he didn't do really... It's one of those things where, like, Matthew McConaughey and Woody Harrelson were listed as executive producers in the second season because I think, you know, you cut a certain deal where you get listed that way and get paid something.
I want to say something. I'm not entirely sure what you just said about... while it is now a Netflix production... I'm not sure if Netflix were in it at ground zero.
Yeah, that's the thing about that. They're calling it Netflix original movie, but I'm going to guess what it is somebody
puts the movie together,
they find a deal, and it becomes a Netflix movie at that point.
So I think it's fair to say that it wasn't originally a creative vision of Netflix. But Netflix have now got involved in this film, which is being played probably in small... you know, independent theaters near you. I don't think it's on wide release.
Yeah, well, here's the big thing, right? So
what I'm saying is it's not at your big multiplex.
A bunch of the chains boycotted it because of this. I mean, that's where the news, like, so they had this plan, like, oh, we'll do the simultaneous release. People have it on Netflix. And when the theaters that it was supposed to appear on got wind of that structure, they're like, no, we're not showing your movie and undercutting ourselves by, like, you know, who's going to buy the tickets here while it's out on Netflix? And so it's a little bit of a standoff of somebody trying to draw a line in the sand, you know, saying, listen, Netflix, you want to do your movies? Go ahead, do your movies. But don't think we're going to cooperate by putting our promotional budget behind it, putting it in our theaters, and people will be like, ooh, neat. I can get Netflix and get these movies at the same time and not go to this theater that's busy promoting the movie.
Because traditionally, films that are available, that doesn't matter if you're a cable or a satellite person, films that are available on your TV the same day as release are films that basically...
Yeah, well, typically it's a problem, right?
They're a problem. So people try and dump them online to try and make some money back. Netflix, I guess you're right. They want to do that now, but they want to do it again. Because this particular film, which is why it was a story, The Beasts of No Nation, is that what it's called? Yep. It played in some independent
movie festivals. Oh, yeah, and I mean, the reviews in the paper, at least a couple of reviews that were very, very good reviews.
So it's quite rare for a film to sort of be good and be in this situation, which does – I just wanted to – I know I normally sit here and promote old shows, like go back and listen to – I do want to promote an upcoming show sometime, you know, probably around – in late November, early December, we will be having our summer movie scorecard show.
Okay.
And I did discover one of the films that we talked about in the summer movie preview was the very last one. It was the Charlize Theron thriller based, I can't remember what it was called.
It's like the thing about the murder case
based on a story by the same author who'd written Gone Girl.
Mm-hmm.
Well, when I went into that, to research its box office. Apparently, sometime at the start of the summer, we had it on our list as a film that would be released.
Yeah.
By the time the release date rolled around, it went straight to video.
Oh, is that right?
Yes. So it has no box office.
Did we say it was going to be a box office success? I think we said it was going to
bomb, so we're both going to get a point for that. But I thought that was interesting that's the old school version of stuff that goes straight to video and you can just get it on your cable box. It's the stuff that no one wants. What makes this unique now is that this is a film that would be released.
Although, it's unique in its particular attributes, but the rationale for why the theaters aren't carrying it is similar. Spite. Like it's well, no, but meaning
spite.
Like so, the Charlize Theron.
We're
one,
not going to carry
and other
a
bad
film.
Movies. The theaters basically, you know, the deal is the theaters are going to lose money because they're going to spend a certain amount of effort putting a theater on, taking up space, putting it on a theater, and taking up space. But it's not going to sell enough tickets. Well, that's got to be the same rational for the big places where they're going, wait a minute, you want me to occupy a theater here with all these seats where somebody can get this stuff at home? I'm going to lose money. And so they say, I'm not going to do it.
I did a bit of research on Netflix in sort of looking this up. And it is interesting to me because, again, I'm not a subscriber. In fact, and I know we are going to talk briefly about Amazon Prime, but we'll circle back to that.
Mm-hmm.
I've never seen the point of subscribing, one, because I'm a minge bag. I don't like paying extra for the sense of things I could already have. And I've always had a sense with Netflix that I'm paying extra for something that, well, I've already paid for once. But in research, so what I'm saying is I don't really know of Netflix as a company other than they're there and they have some TV shows that you might want.
Mm-hmm.
But I actually did some research on Netflix. I didn't realize they're quite international. They've saturated the market in North America. They've saturated the market in Europe. They're trying to get their foothold in Asia. The only part of Europe they're not in is Eastern Europe, like Russia.
Right.
So when you look at a map and if your map of the world is colored in red for Netflix, you know, there's if you can imagine,
it's the former red nations that aren't red.
Yes, they're not red; they're gray on this map. I thought it was interesting that Netflix. You know, I always thought of them as a American English speaking service.
Mm-hmm.
They're not. They're all over the world now.
Well, yeah, I mean, you can imagine that it's probably better in those contexts because they don't have the same infrastructure for distribution of media and the like, and so they do have. If they have internet, then that may be where you get everything.
I'm trying to. I'm looking through here. Streaming accounts, international streaming accounts for 15% of the company's value. So while I guess that seems like a small number, that's quite a big number.
Well, that's where everybody goes for growth. A lot of companies that have started here, technology, they realize they reach a point of saturation here in the United States. They're not going to expand their market share past a certain point. By just promotion, but they can expand themselves by Netflix is going to expect to expand just based on the conversion of people to a more internet-based thing, but they're not going to really get a lot more new subscribers in the United States by putting advertisements out there, whereas every place else they can, right? Like they bring themselves in new, that's an easier way to expand.
The latest figures were for 2 years ago, and it had Netflix with approximately just under 50 million subscribers across the world. And I couldn't decide when I saw that number, thinking it back to this whole conversation about stuff in movies, stuff on streaming TV. I couldn't decide. Is 50 million a lot of people? 50 million people watch the Super Bowl in America.
Mm-hmm.
Well, yeah, you know, more, but yeah. Then again, one episode of a primetime TV show has ratings, you know, to be a top 20 show nowadays in just America, you need to have about 50 million viewers at that moment.
15.
So I then couldn't decide, is 50 million, and I would imagine 50 million and growing, to 60, 70 million. I'm sorry, I can't read my own writing here. They now actually, of 2015, they have 69.17 million subscribers worldwide.
Yeah.
The bulk of that, two-thirds of that is still in the US. So we're now looking at 70 million subscribers. Mm-hmm. So what I'm saying is, if I'm making a motion picture where, you know, any movies are about putting bums on seats. Yes, you're selling goods. You know, we talked the other week about Star Wars paraphernalia. Yes, you've got video and DVD and Blu-ray rights. But at the end of the day, movies make their money from people putting bums on seats. So I couldn't decide if I'm Netflix, if having a captive audience of 70 million people, was that a good or a bad thing to start making the kind of multi-million dollar investment that the movie business is?
Well, you know,
what I couldn't decide.
It's,
I just don't
the
know
math
about.
Is very different, right? Because the movie theater, the movie itself, and going to theaters is pretty clear where you're making your money, right? Like that's why you have box office results. Made the movie, people sold this many tickets, theaters made this much money. That's much money comes back to the places. But if you put it on Netflix, where people are paying per month. Now, it's like you can't even do the same analysis. You just have to say, did it add to our subscriber base? That's a harder question to figure out. In that particular movie, you know, I'm sure at the margin somebody said, ooh, I'm going to subscribe, you know, as a result. But it's really about the fact if they can turn out movies on a regular basis that way will dictate whether it's a success.
Would you let me ask you a question. If there's a film that you wanted to see and it was available the same day, and I'm not talking about, I'm trying to find sort of that I'm not talking about, you know, Star Wars is coming. Those are big films where I think pretty much all of us want to sit back in front of a massive screen and watch them. But again, I guess we mentioned that we were talking about that Charlize Theron movie, and we talked about how it was written by the woman who wrote the book Gone Girl.
Mm-hmm.
Gone Girl is not inherently a big screen experience.
No.
So the question I have for you is, if as a Netflix subscriber, would it be enough that being available either the same day or within the same span it's in the cinema, would that prevent you from going, would you forego your movie-going experience?
Yes. Like this movie itself, I'm interested in this movie. I haven't seen it yet.
But you wouldn't go to the cinema.
I'm not going
to
bother. I can get it free, essentially. I mean, because I have Netflix.
You're getting it free.
I might as well just watch it at home. I got a pretty big screen downstairs, and I'm not going to be motivated to go there. Like you said, other than like the Star Wars things, there's not going to be such a reason to go to a big place. Now, what I think is interesting is, you know, movies have a certain shelf life, right? So you say, hey, I'd like to see that movie, but I'm not running out the door. I'm not trying to go open weekend. I never go to movies opening weekend to begin with. But I'm not running out the door. But you do know this movie's only going to be in the theaters for 2 months or something like that. And if it's a movie you want to see, you know it's going to be some time beforehand. So you will, in fact, you create a sort of a schedule for yourself. We'd like to see this movie then, like to see this movie then, kind of get to it. You know, it's not like every week or anything like that. But here, because this movie's on Netflix, and it really effectively will always be on Netflix, I don't know when I'm going to get around to seeing it. Could be 6 months from now. Like, I've got no motive to, like, go see it sooner, so whatever, I'll get to it. Same thing, like the same thing, we've talked about it before in terms of TV shows and streaming TV shows. You accumulate your TV shows on a DVR, you're likely to watch them. You know, they're there, you know, you want to clear out your DVR. I know you're obsessed about
clearing out your DVR. I'm obsessed. I don't like clearing out your DVR. Yeah, I like to have it.
But as long as it's on demand, and it's always going to be available on demand, what's the rush? I'll get around to it. And a lot of times, of course, you never get around to it.
I can understand. I'm trying to now think from a creative standpoint. If I'm a...
Of course, what do they care as long as you subscribe anyway?
Yeah, but what I'm now thinking about it, if I'm the person making the movie, I don't... Again, I'm sitting here speculating about a business that... Although we are in a form of entertainment, we are, as podcasters.
You know, think about this. Actually, that's all our stuff's available.
Different. Ours is available right away. But I'm thinking if I've made a film, if I'm a film director or I'm a movie producer... I'm not sure I want to make it and then have it released in this form of the never never. And what I mean by that is you are correct.
Yeah,
if you know something's on demand, well, you never actually, too often or not, you don't actually end up watching it.
Right.
If I'm a film producer and I've taken Netflix money and I've got other financing for my $60 million film that I've made, which, to be honest, nowadays, when you look at the budgets of the big films, making a film for $60 million, that is in the low end of the spectrum. I'm not sure that I want my creative product to be not so much trapped, but sort of shoved off in the, I'll get to it later box. There is still something, the movie, the cinemas are releasing it on October the 10th. There is something about it's out there.
Well,
people either walk away, they either walk up and buy their ticket or they don't. But your production, what you've created is out there. The trouble with stuff going to on demand is it's out there and it's not.
Right. Well, so here's an interesting thing.
It's not in the paper. Those folks, not in the movie listings.
Those folks involved in that movie, they know how many people are watching their movie. I mean, that's how they're gonna get paid and the like on their
effort.
But we don't. So that's one of the, you know, we talk about like generally speaking, the modern world, how much information is available. There are certain areas in which information has become reduced. Like movies, it's publicized what the box office is for movies. TV shows, the ratings are publicized. So you know when these are successes or not. Netflix, Amazon Prime, none of them will tell you. Even the streaming radio stations like XM, none of them will tell you how many people are listening. They know how many people are listening. That's how they're making their choices. Yeah. But they won't tell you. So now it puts folks in a funny box where the commentators can't really say what was successful because we don't really know how many people have actually watched that movie. And I'm sure the people who make the movies, you know, they may personally feel good because they'll be like, oh, wow, 60 million people watch my movie on streaming, but they can't go – they're not getting their praises sung in the public, right?
Yeah.
So, like, even think about this. You know, Netflix is going to – this movie is going to be Oscar. Although, actually, one of the big discussions is it an Oscar candidate or an Emmy candidate because it's watching it on TV or whatever.
That's the thing, isn't it?
So let's assume because it was released in the theaters, apparently it makes it eligible for the Oscars. Well, how does somebody evaluate that? Or even on the Emmy side, typically people would know what the ratings are. I know it's all supposed to be critical review, like, oh, is it yes. a good comedy or not? But it matters whether the thing is a success or not. And if you can't really tell how successful something is, where does that put people in terms of evaluating the merits of it?
That said, Netflix, if you want to get into the podcast business, we're more than happy to sell you our show.
I
just find it. I find it interesting. I find it interesting from an audience perspective.
Yeah.
And I find it interesting, too, from a creative perspective. I will say this. I'm not of the opinion that it's going to affect the film industry. Although, let me say this, as someone who's always been a moviegoer, and I've said this many times, the notion of sitting in a big room and a big screen in the dark, that's part of the experience for me. I will always support. Even though I don't go to films as much as I used to, I will always support cinema. I do get where the cinema industry, not the movie industry, I get where they're coming from here. I do understand that, you know something? No, we're not putting this in the cinema because you know something? It's yours. You stick it out on your internet, but we're not doing it.
Yeah.
You know, I'm going to turn over another screen to Star Wars or whatever else it may be right now. And I'm with the cinemas in that way. And like I said, I think this is the interesting thing about Netflix and anyone who's doing it through the small screen. And I appreciate this point. You and I have had versions of this discussion over the years. Yeah, TV is different now. The TV experience is different now because the quality is so much better than it was when we even 15 years ago. We've talked about shows that I don't watch on HBO. They are cinematic quality. This stuff Netflix and anyone else are doing is cinematic quality. But at the end of the day, it's still TV. And again, if I'm in the movie-making business...
The thing is, the difference... I like to say it's still TV. You're like, okay, because it comes through a TV set. But the distinctions are broken down. I mean, it's just not that...
Yeah,
not
no, I get anymore. That.
Hey, so you mentioned Amazon Prime. Just something interesting about Amazon Prime I was going to know. Like, so people don't know, Amazon Prime, if you pay $70 a year or whatever it is, you get a whole bunch of things that Amazon can offer, including free two-day shipping on everything. And there's got a music streaming service, and one of the things is they have video streaming. Some things it's not like Netflix where everything is free, but lots of things are free. Other things you can pay per viewing. But Amazon Prime has something I didn't realize until recently because we were about to travel. You can take the movies with you.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
So Netflix, I can't believe Netflix hasn't figured out a technology because what they're doing is they're allowing you to download it, but it's in some secure format so you can't then just copy and sell it.
Yep.
And things like so Amazon, you're like, you can download a bunch of episodes of TV shows they've got, you can download movies and all that, and now you can go watch them without having a connection. I mean, that's where Netflix has got to go until we all have like ubiquitous connections everywhere and don't have to pay a fortune for data connections from our phone services. That's what they need to go to.
I want to pick up on two things that you've just said there, one on Amazon Prime and then two on the notion of what we were talking about in terms of the cinema and the streaming rental TV services. According to Netflix's number, in 2014, Netflix had twice as many UK subscribers had twice as many people sign up for Netflix than to Amazon Prime. So in UK, in just the UK, according to this article, Netflix felt that they were in front of their competitors. But I also want to make this is an interesting quote that I found in here. It was an interview with Netflix's CEO, and they were talking about, you know, how much the company had spent $3 billion on subscription content. stuff that they wanted to put up, whether that be creating shows like House of Cards and I guess buying movie rights to theater. This was an interesting thing that the Netflix's CEO said about illegal downloading. And I quote, Netflix's CEO further explained that illegal downloading helps to create demand, as users may switch to legal services for an improved user experience. And I found that an interesting public position for someone to take, because again, who's their number one enemy is pirate. Since I was a kid, pirating of films was something that the movie industry have fought against for 40 years. And I found it interesting that the Netflix position was, hey, yeah, you know, illegal downloads, a form of pirating, ultimately does help the downloading business. I found that an interesting public position to take.
I think what they mean
is, so at a certain level, I understand why there is hostility on the part of distributors to Netflix, just in general.
I think they just mean in terms of market development, because this is the same thing that happened with music. Music was illegally downloaded, then folks figured out, you know, if we can provide somebody the same thing more conveniently, doesn't involve them like downloading some weird software and things like that, and it's 99 cents a song, people use it. And the truth is they do, and they still continue to illegally download things, but it's so reduced. So their Netflix position isn't, like, in the long run, you have to squeeze that out.
Would never hear anyone in the movie industry at some moment concede.
Because it's not the same. The point is, for Netflix, it's good because it gets people accustomed to the idea of watching this stuff on their computer and downloading it instead of going to a theater. So it works for them. It doesn't work for the movie theater. People aren't going to be like, oh, I'm having so much fun downloading things, I'm going to go to a movie theater. What they are going to do is say, I'm having so much fun downloads, and I would feel a little bit better if I could download it for only $8 a month or something like that. Now I'm just going to do it through a legal resource.
I get that. So anything else there on Netflix?
Well, another sort of tangential thing I wanted to mention, there was a pretty interesting thing about Pandora, which is a music streaming service, basically music curated, not curated radio stations. Those, you can go like create your own radio station on Pandora.
Okay.
It's not like on demand where it's different songs.
Similar to Spotify?
Like Spotify is, you just go listen to what you want to listen to.
Okay.
Pandora kind of creates these things, and Pandora is cheaper. And you can do Pandora for free. And well, they bought Ticketfly. Ticketfly is a Ticketmaster that has a lot of connection into small venues, like local clubs. So like the best DC small music club, 930 Club, and the company that promotes that is IMP, and they do Meriwether Post. They do a lot of venues that hold, not like they're below your big amphitheaters and below the Verizon Center and
small
the stage
music club.
So a lot of those go through Ticketfly. Ticketfly is this ticket company that does that. Well, Pandora buys Ticketfly, which is not what you'd think. Well, wait a minute. It's a stream music thing. What do they want to make a buy for? Their stated reason was that this is, particularly in the small venues, it's like social networking of music, in that, like, now we offer this stuff, and if you're listening to these different things, now we can promote the fact that we've got a ticket for this little band that might not have found otherwise,
and you're
playing with bands that are like not Taylor Swift, they're at the lower band of things. The thing that they didn't talk about, which I'm pretty sure is probably what they've got in their back in mind, is selling streams of concerts, which is, you know, like there's certain bands, Phish, we've talked about before. Phish's entire tour was available streaming. Like you pay $20 or $30. I can't remember the price was. You could watch any concert there on your couch, big screen. You could put on your speakers. You could have a near concert experience for any concerts across the country, your local ones, the ones across the country and things like that. I suspect if I'm Pandora, what I'm thinking is I have all the streaming infrastructure. Like, I have the ability to put music out there. If I can get my fingers into all the venues through the ticket things, now what I can do is, in addition to helping sell the tickets, I can convince people, hey, let me put a camera there. Let me get some good microphones in there. And forget about, like, you know, your local club that might have 500 people. I may be able to sell 20,000 streams to that across the country to the people who want to see the small band. Obviously, those people aren't going to show up at your little venue. Your venue's sold out most of the times for these sort of concerts. This is just extra money that I can get from people streaming this stuff for, you know, like, let's say the ticket to go in there was $30. What if I sell a stream for $10? Sure, a lot of people would do that on a Saturday night. They want to hang around, watch some music, or they just have it on the background in their party or whatever it is.
Screen TV.
That kind of thing. So that, I think, I suspect that, and nobody really talked about that, but I suspect there's some sort of plan about that.
Well, it's funny. I'm now going to bring that quick snippet and Netflix back to the Netflix part of our show back together again. Someone might stream it at their local movie theater.
Yeah, well, and they do that too. Like, so the Grateful Dead concerts and a bunch of other concerts and operas and things have been streamed at the theater.
I haven't mentioned my mother for a while, bless her. Right now, Benedict Cumberbatch, who was the villain in the last Star Trek movie. Right. He's currently Sherlock Holmes on TV, which I don't watch. He's in a production of Hamlet in the West End. And of course,
West End being London theater.
The West End of London. They can't find enough seats for everyone.
Right.
My mom was very proud to announce that she'd got a ticket to see Benedict Cumberbatch in Hamlet. And I was like, oh, that's a big deal. That's sold out. And then she had to explain that it's at a local. But I found it interesting that my mom, of all people, sure, who is an old-fashioned theater goer,
yep,
everywhere she goes, she likes going to the theater. I've not seen anything like that in my local cinema. I've never seen a concert or an opera or anything. I've seen it advertised at my local movie theater, but I'm like, why would I want to do that? I'd rather come down to the cinema to watch a film. My mom is going to watch a live performance of Hamlet playing in, you know, the old Vic or whatever the famous theater is. She's going to go down to a local cinema to watch it. And I found that interesting.
Yeah, I've seen a concert that way. At the time, it was in, you know, big multiplex. And so it was not the same experience, because if I go see a band, usually I'm at a bar. I want to be able to, oh, that song's not so good, I'll go back to the bar. But now there's all these theaters that have bars in them. Yeah. That could be the next thing for them as you go there.
But that being said, if you're Pandora, I think this is a pretty low risk investment.
Yeah, like even if their stated rationale is the only thing they do, I think that'll be pretty successful for them. And it's not like Ticketfly was unsuccessful. It's just that they got offered a bunch of money to get bought.
Yeah.
And so now here you got a company putting together, like, you know, Pandora, I don't think makes any money. I'm pretty sure Ticketfly does make money.
Yeah.
So they're buying a thing that makes money and supports the rest of what they're doing. Well, we've kind of gone through a bunch. Show, I mean, like, just brief flash of while I'm gone.
Can I talk about that?
Go ahead.
And I know some of you are out there realize that we missed schedule last week. That's because my partner here was under the weather, so we didn't do a show. But obviously,
you may still hear me coughing a little bit this episode.
I know. They would have heard you coughing. It's no point. That's just boring.
No. I mean, just this episode. Oh, okay. I've had a couple of coughs where I've had to hit the mute, so you can probably hear that fainting.
Explaining why. Yeah. So you're going away, but again, fans out there, I know you probably feel a little bit like you've been rationed. Don't worry. I've cut together a Star Wars special to play while you're away, because Star Wars, the film, is coming up.
Doesn't have anything about the new trailer, because, of course,
that was just this week.
Yeah, yeah.
But I'll let you listen to the show itself. But we are mirroring the real-life making of Star Wars, how you would have known about it if you were only listening to us.
That's right.
So you're going to hear us talk about Star Wars for now. And again, I'm going to say this now, and I say it in the show, especially early in the process, you are unbelievably accurate with some of the primary research before anything had happened. Some of the research that you'd done and some of our prognostications are eerily accurate. And I'm not just talking about the plot of the film.
Right.
I'm just talking about the way the whole thing is unfolding. So you can hear that. So that will be played while you're away.
And maybe when we come back, we do a recap. We were talking about doing it, but we're running out of time. Mentioned the fact that there's a Bond movie coming out in a week. Or 2 weeks.
We've got a few minutes. I'm going to say something about the Bond movie.
Spectre.
Spectre is the Bond movie. I'm a big Bond fan. I have noticed, and we've spent a lot of this episode talking about streaming and cinema and this kind of thing. The one thing I've noticed about the current Bond promotional campaign, there was the first teaser trailer way back at the beginning of the year. There was only one official trailer. But the internet has been flooded with the 30-second TV-ready trailers. There are about 12 of those running.
Mm-hmm.
And I find that a slight adjustment, especially in comparison to example, just in comparison with Star Wars, which has had 1 minute teaser, a second 1 minute teaser, then a first trailer, then a full trailer. I've noticed the Bond movie has gone the other way around. There is really only one official trailer, but the internet and the chat rooms and shortly coming to a TV near you, there are at least a dozen different 30-second TV internet ready clips, and I just find that interesting.
Yeah, they're trying a different method.
Yeah,
like as you were saying before we got on, it's like, you know, Star Wars is sucking a lot of air out of the room. So maybe they're looking for their
different sort
their
of
approaches.
Yeah. But it's interesting there's very little buzz.
I'm going to suggest that when we talk about the recap of the summer movies, maybe we take some time and talk about, because by then we'll know what's going on with Bond in terms of how it does. It's going to do fine, right? Like this movie is not going to do bad. But the question is it going to do better than the last ones that had way more hype behind them?
No, it's going to come short.
Yeah, so that would be interesting.
To me, I think.
But I mean, let's we can talk about what happens.
But that interesting battle is going to be Star Wars and Jurassic World. But we're going to talk about Jurassic World's performance again coming up.
And because it comes out, the Star Wars comes out December 18th. I don't know how they'll do the year, but maybe the stats will come out there. But I mean, I'm predicting that movie will be maybe the biggest movie of all time.
But so that's what's coming down the line, a Star Wars special. Then when you're back, I'm sure we'll be hearing about your trip across the globe.
Mm-hmm.
We've also got our summer movie scorecard, and we're also getting to the time of year.
Holiday season coming up. If you got any ideas, send them in.
Yeah, because we're a bit stuck for our Christmas special this year.
Yep.
And really, do you want to just hear us ramble on about anything?
they must, because that's all we do.
Do we have anything else for this show?
No.
This has been the Atlantic Voice Podcast. I'm Zeph.
I'm Eric. Take care.
You've just enjoyed Eric and Zeph on the Atlantic Voice Podcast. Follow us on Twitter at @Atlantic_voice. You can find the show at libsyn.com, iTunes, and of course at atlanticvoice.net. Email us at atlanticvoice@gmail.com. And now on YouTube, search for the Atlantic Voice. The Atlantic Voice, 3,000 miles of opinion.